Match of my life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
Okay, fascinating guest in today on Match of My Life. He's the man behind, partly behind a cultural revolution, of course, for Liverpool fans. Boss Nights has become something of a must-go-to event. So let's find a little bit more about that and Dan Nicholson's life as a football fan as well. Morning to you, Dan.
Good morning.
Dan Nicholson, Boss Nights, are they intrinsically entwined now?
I don't know. Probably not, because you know, it's not. It's not me. I'm often the face that gets wheeled out, but there is a few of us behind this. I'd never say it's anything to do with me. We created a platform, and it's the likes of Jamie Webster, yeah, the other artists, and of course everyone that comes to our nights that make it what it is. Not really to do with me.
What is Boss Nights for someone who's not been? How do you explain?
Okay, so I started a fanzine back in 2007 called Boss. It was very organic, very homegrown. It was black and white. It was a pound. It was really authentic.
You used to sell it outside the ground, did you?
Not quite, because I think in the true spirit of a fanzine, we didn't really want to sell it. We released it in October 2007. I got a few mates together. We were going home and away with Liverpool at the time, and there were lots of really, really good things happening. There were funny things happening at away games. And for me, lots of culturally significant things that were happening. We were in the build-up to 2008, European capital culture. The football was really linked at the time, and still is, you know, to music, to fashion. There's lots going on, and I felt that it wasn't quite being recorded. I felt that as good as the internet is, and you know, my day job is the internet. I run a web development company, so you know, I live and breathe the internet. But you know, I felt that there was nowhere for these stories to be recorded. There was no record. Something goes online, something went on a message board back in 2007, and it'll be on page 2, 3, or 4 within an hour. And if you're lucky, there might be some responses, but those responses may not be the most positive. Remember the lads, some mates of ours went down to Fulham away at the end of the 2006-2007 season, and they bumped into the Chelsea team bus. And they end up jumping on the bus and they had the Liverpool flag. And
it's like,
it's a funny story, and the lads often talk about it now. But someone wrote it up and put it on one of the more mainstream LFC websites. And they got lambasted for it by, you know, people around the world. You know, that's not the Liverpool way, that's not funny. And for what we thought was quite funny and quite authentic, you know, like young lads going the match, you know, winding up, you know, the Chelsea team. It didn't go down so well. And I remember that was a bit of a catalyst moment for me.
It was treated as thuggery, was it?
Yeah, sort of, by, you know, people thousands of miles away. And I remember thinking at the time, well, actually, no, that's something that ought to be recorded. And ought to be recorded in a way that doesn't disappear on the internet. And also could be presented to people that would appreciate it.
Yeah.
So over that summer, I was thinking, and I mentioned to a few mates, the idea of getting a fanzine together. I think fanzine culture with football is something that is really, really important. It's important today as it was back in the 80s, you know, what would be considered the peak of fanzines.
Yeah, because your more traditional fanzine would not really have broached those sorts of things, would
maybe
they?
Maybe not. So I mean, but my idea was back I say, in 2007, we're going to be mates together. None of us are writers. And we just said, we're going home and away. We were all in our early 20s, you know, we'd sort of done our rites of passage, you know, the going on Barnes travel type thing, and you know, working on Tuesday with the match kind of thing. So I said, you know, maybe it's now time we record our stories. And there was nothing sort of elitist about it. There was nothing like, you know, we're better than anyone else, anything like that. It was literally, let's just record what's going on. It was all anonymous. You know, we didn't want anyone to be superstars in it. You know, we didn't carry any adverts. There was no monetary. There was no sort of incentive around money. There was nothing that we thought we were going to be millionaires off this, anything like that. We literally printed this magazine, got it photocopied, and we put, I think it was 100, 200 copies in the Hillsborough Justice Campaign shop before a game in October 2007. And it went right away. There was a real appetite for it. People walking around. And a lot of people were like, who's doing this? Because there were no names in it as such. So we had to go away and get 1,000 printed for the next game. And they sold out straight away.
So you knew you were onto something.
So we knew we were onto something. But as I say, it was never about, oh, we're going to make loads of money. Our aim with it, our objective was something physical that goes in your back pocket, that records what's going on at the match for us as young lads in our early 20s, going home and away, and then coming back from like an away game, going straight to a gig in town, that kind of thing. Something that in 20, 30 years' time could be picked up
And do you think it appreciated when you first released them to that demographic? You say lads in their early 20s. Did you know it was a specific sort of person who was?
Yeah, do you know, and that's why we didn't start outside the ground. Do you know, we simply was sort of word of mouth. You can get it from the HAC shop. Maybe took a few like to the other way game to try and sell, but it was never a case of standing on flagpole corner at the side of the cop. You know, having tourists come up to us say, "Is that the programme?" It was never about them. You know, it was just about doing something, as I say, for us. And the important thing for me was that it was something physical that could be picked up in 20, 30 years' time.
So where did it go to from there?
So we did that through to 2016, and we did it really sporadically. We were quite lazy at times, and it was never something that we ever forced. We did 16 issues in those 9 years.
So you weren't overworking yourself,
Dan? No, far from it. But I think what we did record at that time was a true picture of what was going on with us. And it was as much about the music. It was about the off-the-pitch stuff, about the music. It was about the culture of the city. It was about the clothes. It was about the observations of the city as much as it was about football. So I don't think at any time did we actually even mention on the pitch football as such. It was about everything that was going on around the game. The stories, you know, the funny stuff, the insightful stuff. As I say, we did that for 9 years. But along the way, because music was so closely linked to what we were doing, it was back in 2011 we thought, we put on a gig. Because we were doing a lot of promoting our mates in the magazine, and mates who were in bands. So we thought, well, why don't we do a little starter season party? So I think it was the 2011-2012 season. We hired a place in town and simply said, you know, we're going to do a gig and a few of our mates who are in bands, you know, we're going to put them on. And I think that's like £5 a ticket.
High-profile bands or bands?
The T-Street band, yeah. So the T-Street band called the Hummingbirds.
Yeah.
That Mark Frith was in. Just our mates in bands. And it was all going to be linked by basically like a DJ set of music that we were into, the sort of Liverpool, Manchester, indie type scene. And it went down really well. Put you know, 300-400 tickets on sale, and they sold out straight away. And we thought, well done, not only have we got this little magazine in our hands, we can actually start doing gigs as well. It was quite fun. You know, we were just a little group of mates doing this kind of thing as a hobby. And as I said, you know, it was never about us. It was about creating that platform for stuff that was going on in the city. You know, we've always been big about people that do stuff.
Funny because you've given a portal there to a certain area of things that always existed.
Yeah.
You know, even in the 80s, 90s music.
Absolutely,
fashion,
absolutely.
Football, so they're all intrinsically connected,
course,
aren't they?
And we've done nothing new.
No, you just joined the dots, didn't you?
That sort of platform, yeah. So we did that first gig, I'd say, went down really well, and then we started doing other gigs. I'd say it was just all about, you know, our mates are in a band here, so we'll put them on, give them the platform. We know we've got the audience there, just marry the two up. And they were really, really good mates that came out of it. If we fast forward a bit to, would it be, I think, 2012-2013 season. We had a load of Sunday games because we were in the UEFA Cup. And at the time, there wasn't really anywhere in town for all the lads to go, the away games to go. Everyone used to go to Ned Kelly's on Victoria Street. And then I think people started going to the Yankee Bar and stuff. But there's nowhere like real big place for all the lads to get together. And we thought, having all these early kickoffs on a Sunday, how about if we do something like a little bit of a Sunday session? So we called it the Boss Sunday Session. And the idea was, it was free to get in, because as I say, it's never been about, you know, making loads of money, anything like that. Just get a venue in town, put a few of the lads on, playing acoustic guitar, whatever, you know, have a little DJ set, that kind of thing. But essentially, it's a bit of a meeting place for our mates to get together. That's all it's ever been about, getting our mates together. So we started doing that, and it sort of snowballed from there.
And it went ballistic from there.
It did, yeah, but the principles still remain the same. Still remain the same for everything we do now. It's about just getting our mates together.
Right, and so that's it. It's a family, it's a very community-based sort of idea. But there must have been a stage where all of a sudden you realised it had gone, I wouldn't say ballistic, it had gone to a next level.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think,
and when was that?
Well, I think the internet's really helped with that. Even if you go back 2, 3, 4 years, getting a video out there on Twitter, Facebook, that kind of thing, it's not as easy as it is now. So I think what we found over the past 18 months, 2 years, we've done some big nights. We tend to do our nights over in District now, over in the Baltic Triangle. And some of the videos have just gone mad from there. I think when the LA, LA, LA song broke through last season, Jamie played it after we did a boss session, as we call them, after Man United away. So this is simply, you know, for people that don't know, it's a warehouse. We're there on a Saturday afternoon after the Man United game. Various lads coming back on different coaches. Then the coaches are dropping off in the Baltic Triangle. And the next minute, it's just full of all the lads that have been to Old Trafford. We got beat that day. But I think one thing we can say about Liverpool fans is that, you know, it is a bit of a party firm. You know, no matter what the score is, you know, people can quickly put it to the back of their minds. So particularly the hardcore, the lads who go home and away, can quickly put it to the back of their minds and just get on with having a laugh and a good drink. So we're all in there after United, and, you know, the music's playing, really good atmosphere. Jamie gets up, Jamie Webster does his usual set, which isn't all Liverpool songs. There was a mixture of...
No, he's a great artist, isn't he?
And now his own music as well, you know, which is, it's just as good as anything that he's playing by anyone else. And they played LA, 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 and it just went mad in there. And we got a video of it from on the stage, and we uploaded it the next morning to Twitter and Facebook. And within 12 hours or something, had 1 million-plus hits, and you've got... You know, the Lad Bible and all those people that ripped the content down, re-putting it out on their channels, it just went ballistic. And I think that was the sort of tipping moment in terms of the coverage that we were getting and our reach.
It's interesting, that connection with music and the football. And actually, if you went back to last season and some of the scenes against Man City or Roma, and whether it be the scenes outside the ground or in the ground, when you hear that being sung, and there must be a slight tinge of, wow, I was involved, or... You know, we were part of something that created.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, you know, from my point of view, I never claimed to be.
Absolutely, but it was an involvement.
It's good. Yeah, it's good.
From a group that started out as just some lads wanting to be together and enjoying something outside of the football, you've actually had an impact within the football itself.
Yeah. I mean, that is good. You know, I'm really interested in the fan culture. It's been something that's really interested me from a young age. So to be involved in this kind of thing, you know, it is something that does make me proud. I think it is something that is positive. You know, it's quite fun. We often get a bit of stick from other fans. You know, get onto yous all going to a warehouse, you know, to listen to music and drink beer with your mates. Actually, it sounds like the perfect
night.
Have
a party.
You know, exactly. You know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of misgivings from people out there. You know, a few weeks ago, the Man City fans saying, oh, they all pay £20 to get into these after every game. You don't, it's free. You know, it's never, 95% of what we've done over the years has been free, often at a cost to us. Because, you know, often the venues aren't free to hire, the equipment isn't free, all that kind of thing. But we've been able to do a lot of stuff for free because we've had that thing, which is we're just doing this for our mates, you know, for a good time. And that's all it is. You know, it is quite fun.
All sorts of people have bought into it. Yeah, you're Jamie Carragher's. See, you had him on stage singing with Jamie Webster.
So that was a bit of a different night, that. So we did a Q&A with Jamie Carragher. So Brian Reid interviewed Jamie Carragher on stage a few weeks back, and then Jamie Webster did a set after it. It still was a boss event. It was in association with the 23 Foundation, and we were raising money for Sean Cox. Something we've done over the years. I think, given that we have got this audience and we have got this pull, you know, I think we can do a social good. We can give back to our community, whether that is the likes of Sean Cox. We've done fundraising for the likes of Mick Woodburn, a mate of ours, who, and a mate of a lot of people, goes to away games, who tragically passed away earlier in the season. We've done stuff for Now for Others, that kind of thing. And I think there is an element of social good. And that night with Cara a few weeks back was really fun. And it did result in the very end with Cara getting up with Jamie on stage.
He's not a bad singer. He looks like Liam Gallagher or something, doesn't he?
He had a certain stance about him, didn't he?
He's next to, and again, you paid tribute to Jamie Webster, but he's quite at the heart, isn't he, of what Boss Night is?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's been on an interesting journey. We put him on about 5-6 years ago with the Boss of the bill, and we had a night in the middle of town before we moved out to the Baltic Triangle. It was after the derby, actually. It was a chaotic night, you know, absolute lockout, about 400 people outside, you know, hundreds inside, and this young lad called Jamie Webster gets up. He would have been 18-19 at the time. Someone had put him in touch with a lad called Kyle, who we were doing the nights with at the time. I said, there's a kid who gets on our bus who can play guitar. And Jamie loved me. He was relatively shy at the time, so we speak to him and he says, yeah, I'll get up and do, like, you know, 5 or 6, you know, Oasis, the Jam, the Clash, whatever. So we're like, yeah, sound, because that's what we were all about, just giving people that platform. So he gets up and he was really good. So we say to him, well, the next one, then you'll go up the bill a tiny bit. And within three or four events, he was headlining, and he's been there ever since.
Class, class lad. Does Boss Nights have any ambitions to be bigger or change its identity from what
it
is?
No, 100%. No, absolutely not. You know, I think with what we've done, we've been able to achieve it by I think being authentic and, you know, just I say, creating that platform for the lads from the match, you know, and staying sort of loyal to the hardcore, you know, who are essentially our mates. You know, we're not going to all of a sudden sell out and do something mad. One thing that we are really enjoying, though, is taking the show on the road. When we do our nights in Liverpool, you know, it is very much, you know, for those lads after the match, come down to District, have a good time. It's lots of attention from people overseas who want to be a part of it. And I think it's a real positive thing if we can help spread that culture. So we've done stuff in the States with of course that was with the club, but we've done stuff in Dubai, Dublin. We're going to Belfast in a few weeks.
To Belfast, kind of I was there at the weekend with Jamie Carragher, and they were talking about your night before the tickets had gone on sale.
Madness. They went on sale. Insane. So they went on sale on Monday and sold out in a minute. It's
doing something right.
Yeah. But it's good that we can take that culture overseas.
Right, we're going to talk footy next. My guest is Dan Nicholson, and it's Match of My Life. And of course, he's been involved in Liverpool's Boss Nights, but he is a massive red.
Match of My Life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.
Let's continue our Match of My Life with Dan Nicholson, one of those behind Liverpool's Boss Nights. And just to continue on the culture theme and what Liverpool sort of has at the moment in terms of whether it be the media coverage or the fan organisations, we're pretty spoilt, aren't we, currently, Dan?
I think we are. I think the club have really embraced the fan culture side of things, which you couldn't have said a number of years ago. I think whether it's the stuff that we're doing, the freedom that the likes of LFC TV have got and, you know, to produce amazing content, the club's engagement with groups like 1906 and Spirits of Shankly, it's all really, really positive at the minute.
And they want to get involved, it seems.
Absolutely.
And with the correct people.
Absolutely. I think there's lots of trust involved at the minute as well. So, you know, speaking for us, when we went on the tour to the US in the summer with the club, we weren't asked to compromise on anything. So they didn't come to us and say, okay, you know, we're taking ownership of you now and you need to do this, this and this. They came to us and said, what do you want to do? So in the same way I spoke before about giving our mates a platform to do stuff, they gave us a platform to do stuff in the US. And I think it really worked well. You know, the reception we got over there was incredible. You know, the US fans really, really lapped it up and wanted to be a part of it. You know, they'd seen the videos, they'd read the news articles and stuff of what we do here, and they wanted to experience that. And the club let us get on with it. I think it's something that, as I say, you know, the fans want. I think it's something very valuable to the club as well. I've said this a few times since the summer, but my observation from going on that North American tour, I think if you're a US soccer fan and you support Manchester United, you're probably supporting them because you perceive them as the biggest club in the world. If you're a US fan and you support Man City, you're probably supporting them because of the chance or the probability of winning a trophy. Think if you're a US Liverpool fan, you know, you want that as well. But ultimately, you want to buy in to something. You want to buy into the fans, the flags, the songs, that culture around the match, because you've read the books, you've seen the videos, and you've heard the podcast, that kind of thing. You want to be part of it. And I think what the club sort of realised was that they can't deliver that because they are the club. Mm. I think when clubs try to deliver fan culture from the top down, it never ever work. So you see us, you know, walking out, whether it's Chelsea or Man City with the plastic flags, all that kind of thing. You know, it's never going to work when the club tries to impose something on the fans. But it's from the grassroots up, it does work. So what we found when we were in the States, they wanted to embrace it. They wanted to be a part of what we were bringing to them. So they weren't all standing there, you know, decked out head to toe in the replica kits and the shin pads and all that, you know, looking at the on the pitch stuff. They were more bothered about sort of waving a red and white bar scarf above their head, singing LA, LA, LA. There was that element of it. And I think, as I say, that can only come from the fans. And there's lots of trust from the club at the minute. And I think people like, you know, Tony Barrett, Tom Cassidy at the club are really helping help him with that.
Bridge that connection.
Yeah. And I think, you know, having fans on the media side as well, you know, LFC TV, you've got Mark Plath, Phil Reed, plenty of others that really, you know, the cop season ticket holders, you know, they get what it means. And I think, you know, it's really coming to fruition now.
And perhaps ultimately the binding connection through everything is the current manager and his love and his fun.
Absolutely.
You know, because you guys are all about having fun, both whether it be in the football or out of it. And yeah. He just looks like he's one of those that breeds it.
You know, his smile's infectious, isn't it? Well, let's put it this way. If Roy Hodgson was in charge, you know, I don't think it would be this active off the pitch. But yeah, you know, he's infectious. You know, it comes from him. And I think, you know, to paraphrase him, you know, it's about the journey. It's about having fun. So when as fans, you know, we're getting a little bit giddy singing, you know, we're going to win the league and stuff. I'm not sure anyone actually believed 2-3 months ago we were going to win the league, but we're having fun along that journey that Jürgen talks about. Let's see what happens in May.
Right, talking of football fun, it is Match of My Life. So let's get to the root of what means the most to you as a football game. So presumably a supporter from a very young age.
Yeah, so my dad's always gone the match. So from a very, very, very young age, you know, football. And the whole matchday routine was a part of my life and my brother's life growing up.
And always regulars, or
yeah, pretty
just
much.
When your dad
no, from a very, very young age. And as I say, my dad had always gone the game. You know, he'd been there in the '70s and eighties, home and away. You know, like when you see a lot of the photos that do the rounds of like the lads in the late '70s, early '80s, all those photos are my dad's photos. So I know he had Chucky on a few weeks back. You know, he regularly puts them out on the Transalpino Instagram feed. And somewhere along the way, they've gone from my dad's photo album to Mono, well-known Red from Aylward, and then onto Chucky, that kind of thing. So for us, you know, growing up football and Liverpool FC and the whole culture around the match was always something that was there.
You can perhaps sometimes predict someone's Match of My Life by their age.
So
for me, and as soon as your Match of My Life came through, I thought, well, yeah, that's probably about the right time or the right period for someone to be experiencing their football high.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, you've picked 2001.
Yes.
Which I think in some ways is a much underrated season.
Well, for me, I was 16 years of age at the time. And I think when people get asked to think about their most memorable game, they all think back to that sort of coming of age of going the match. So, I mean, the obvious one would have been dead easy for me today, say Istanbul. Everyone's going to say
too
that.
Too easy.
But I gave it some thought. And for me, the most memorable period of me going the match would have been that 2000-2001 season. Everyone who ends up going the away games and stuff goes on this sort of rites of passage. So, as I say, I'd have been 16, 17, 2000, 2001. Being, you know, going to Anfield for numerous years and understanding what was happening, understanding the makeup of the fans and, you know, the whole culture around the game. And you get to that sort of 14, 15, 16 years of age and you start going to the away games. So, you know, the odd few with your dad. But then you get to the point where you take the rite of passage that many of us have done and you step onto Barnes Travel for the first time. So with one or two mates from school at 15, 16 years of age, and you get on and you sit at the front and you work out the hierarchy, basically, of who's who. As I say, you get on almost at the start of the season as a one or two, and you come off at the end of it as like a big mob. You know, you've met your mates at the match, and in the end, you graduate then to different coaches and or your own bus, as we ended up doing. But for me, at 2000-2001 season, I was going to a hell of a lot of the away games, having loads of fun along the way. I'm not sure anyone had huge expectations that season, looking back. I don't think it was a season where we expected to come out at the end of it with three trophies like we did. And along the way, you know, we had some downs along with the ups. I think back to Middlesbrough away on Boxing Day. I remember getting on a double-decker Barnes Travel coacher at the Rocket at like 10 a.m. Boxing Day. It was absolutely freezing. And we got beat 1-0 that day. It was the infamous time Sander Westerveld said there was ice on the ball, if you remember. But it just sort of stands out, as I say, a bit of a sort of coming-of-age thing, you know, where you're sort of working out how the match works. But the second part of the season, it really came to life. We had the UEFA Cup, which was when the UEFA Cup was good.
Yeah, it meant something.
Yeah, the idea now of the Europa League, with, you know, you've got you've got many chances with it being a group game, but this was pure knockout.
And the teams in it were fabulous. Barca, Roma.
Exactly. Very romantic teams. Yeah. Even at the beginning, Liberec, Bucharest, Olympiacos, as you say, Roma, Barcelona, Porto. These big names who were on this amazing run. But it was the FA Cup for me. I think as a 16-year-old, sort of growing up around traditional football, the FA Cup was the one. We're nearly 20 years on now, and I think to ask a 16-year-old now what they think of the FA Cup, they wouldn't look at it in quite the same way. But back then, it felt really, really special. I remember the third round was Leeds United away. We beat them 2-0 that day, two fairly late goals. I think it must have been Heskey and Barnby. But going to Leeds, it was this cauldron. It was everything you'd sort of read about in the books. It was everything you'd heard in the stories. It was intense. The Leeds fans, very traditional fan base. And it just felt something on that day.
It lived up to expectations.
It was a true cup game. Yeah. I think we played Man City the next round. We played Tranmere after that. And then we played Wickham at Villa Park. We got a fairly late goal to go through to the final, and we are back down to Cardiff. We'd already been to Cardiff once that season in the League Cup final in February. I think it was beginning to already feel like a bit of a special place for Scousers, going back down there. And on this day, we drove down in the car. I had my GCSEs starting on the Monday. So we go down the Saturday morning in the car. We step out in Cardiff. I just remember it being roasting. We must have got there like 10 a.m. in the morning, and it must have been 20-odd degrees already. And it was just a sea of red and white. I think the culture at that point, the fan culture, the off-the-pitch culture was really strong. I think an off-the-pitch culture is often linked to success or the chances of success. And certainly that season, there were loads of flags, getting into that space where, the funny flags or the thinking man's type flags, that kind of thing, were starting to pop up. It seemed like that year, every single player had their own song. So the atmosphere was just electric in Cardiff. And you couldn't help but think, this is ours. We're going to win. Did this, no problem. And we get into the ground, and it changed. Because Arsenal were dominant.
Well, Arsenal were unbelievable as a side.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that pre-game confidence that a lot of us had went, because they were relentless. If I remember correctly, I think they had a few chances that were cleared off the line.
With hands. With Honcho's hands.
Yeah, exactly. And then inevitably they got the goal, probably halfway through the second half. And all of a sudden, like many times in football, you're brought back down to earth. You got that disappointment, that sort of thinking, that's it, time's running out. And then Michael Owen, of course, popped up, 1-1. Would have been the 83rd, 84th minute or something, certainly less than 10 minutes to go. And at that stage of the game, you're thinking, well, it's extra time now. There's no way we're going to get another one. But in the most romantic of fashions, Paddy Berger knocks the ball through. Owen probably running the fastest 100 metres of his life, controls the ball, runs with it. I think at the time, I can picture now walking. It seemed like slow motion, but he slots her. And then he runs towards me. There's 85,000 people on this ground, but I'm thinking he's looking at me because we were in the lower tier. First tier, right in the corner, and he's running. And it just feels like for that moment, he's running towards you. Mm-hmm. We were on row 12. I ended up on about row 4 or something, down the front. And that was it, job done. There was no way back for Arsenal from there. We'd won the cup final. And it doesn't get any better than I was a 16, 17-year-old.
The romance of that moment.
Yeah, that will live with me forever. And of course, we went on to win the UEFA Cup. And arguably, we won, in inverted commas, a fourth trophy that season by getting in Champions League as well. I was going to say for the first time.
And a Super Cup.
But of course. But, that Champions League qualification, getting back to that top level of European Cup football was equally as special, I think.
But that defining few minutes as he ran to you means the world to you in terms of a football feeling that you almost can't replicate.
Yeah.
And you see, I remember being in the commentary box and looking down and the bit where Owen's got his arms sprayed out and there's someone on his back, I can't remember. But that seemed to be a snapshot of something that's just stood still for ages.
Yeah, and he gets a lot of stick now, Owen. But for me, I'll never, ever forget that.
that moment he gave you. Dan Nicholson, absolutely brilliant chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Best of luck with the continued success of Boss Nights. Is there anything anyone needs to know about it? Or
well, we've got
up?
A big show in Munich today, big right. gig in Munich. So I'd say it's frustrating that I'm not there. I feel like I'm the only Liverpool fan left in the city this morning, but unfortunately I had a few work things on.
Hey, but you're here. Don't worry about it.
Yet. So, yeah, I feel a bit lonely today. But yeah, I've got a big night in Munich today. And we'll just continue doing what we're doing. Do you know, it's very organic and there's no real plan to it, but just about having a bit of fun.
It works. You can follow them on social media. Dan, thank you. Boss Nights, well done. And if you're heading to Munich today, make sure you get to that event. It should be brilliant.
Match of my life. Life stories and greatest games.
Radio City Talk.